This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
If you're a baseball fan, you know who Bill James is. In the 1970s and 80s, James changed the way we think about our national pastime. His baseball abstracts found new ways to assess player performance beyond just counting the big numbers like home runs, RBIs, and wins. James is a senior advisor to the Boston Red Sox. It turns out he's also a big fan of crime stories, and he's written a new book called Popular Crime: Reflections on the Celebration of Violence. The book takes readers on a journey from Lizzie Borden to the Boston Strangler to O.J. Simpson, and it explores what crime and our obsession with crime says about who we are. And Bill James, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. So I was thinking about how to make some clever link between your love and involvement with baseball and your apparent love for crime stories, and I couldn't come up with one. And then this morning I suddenly thought, aha, baseball, one of America's obsessions, and crime, another sort of favorite American thing. I don't know how that strikes you.
Congratulate you on accomplishing that leap without mentioning Barry Bonds. That's great.
But what does crime say about who we are? And what is it that draws you to these stories?
Crime stories reveal an aspect of human nature that we otherwise keep very carefully disguised and hidden and put away. Crime stories are among the most interesting things in the newspaper when I was growing up or all around us because they tell us something about ourselves that we otherwise don't like to talk about.
And fascinated you in particular, right? You've been reading crime stories your whole life.
I have, yes.
Yeah. Let me ask you, if I could, to read something from your book. It's early on in the first section of the book on page 7, right at the top of the page there, just through that first paragraph.
We are, not as a nation, but as human beings, fascinated by crime stories, even obsessed with them. The Bible is full of them. On your television at this moment, there are 4 channels covering true crime stories and 5 doing detective fiction. And yet, on a certain level, we are profoundly ashamed of this fascination. If you go into a good used bookstore and ask if they have a section of crime books, you will get one of 2 reactions. One is the clerk will look at you as if you had asked whether they had any really good pornography. The other is they will tell you that the crime books are down the aisle on your left in the alcove beside the detective stories, right next to the pornography.
Well, you take us on quite a journey, so let's talk about some of these crime stories and begin to talk about what some of them tell us about who we are. Let's start where you start with Lizzie Borden, probably one of the first great crime stories that this country dealt with, about a New England spinster who allegedly killed her father and stepmother, Fall River, Massachusetts. She was acquitted, but she's remained a notorious figure in American folklore. You don't believe she did it.
I don't. And the reason is the time sequence on the Borden murders is very, very tight. Andrew Borden was seen downtown in Fall River at 10:35. He walked home, was admitted to his home about 10:45. He went upstairs, picked up some papers, laid down to take a nap. Lizzie Borden ran to her neighbors crying that her father had been murdered just after 11 o'clock. There's very, very little time. It is my belief that in a modern police investigation, she would immediately be eliminated because the police would immediately see that if she had committed the murder, she would have to be covered with blood, which she was not.
Because the murders were actually, in fact, the poem sort of says a lot. Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41.
Right.
Does that conform with any kind of accuracy? I mean, in terms of the way that the murder was evidently committed.
It overstates the number of whacks, but these were terrible, bloody murders involving more than a dozen hatchet blows to each victim.
And what did this particular crime story do to the public in the way that it was followed, in the way that it was processed, in the way that people paid attention to it?
Well, this happened at a moment at which the media was getting organized. The news services that dominated the 20th century, Associated Press, UPI, and others, those were just getting organized about that time, and this information about the crime spread a little more rapidly than it had in the past.
Another story along those lines with a great local connection that you write about is the Boston Strangler. Some 14 murders in the Boston area that began in the early 1960s. Eventually, F. Lee Bailey, the great defense attorney, gets involved and helps cut a deal for Albert DeSalvo, who says he was the Boston Strangler, you and others don't believe it. Why not?
Well, I know it's difficult for people to accept that because we've been told that he was the Boston Strangler for many years. However, when you reach the point at which you say, what really is the evidence against Albert DeSalvo, it's quite astonishing how thin it is.
There was no eyewitness.
There's no eyewitness.
There was no physical evidence, right?
Right, that's right.
And in fact, he wasn't even indicted, was he, or formally charged?
He was never indicted, charged, tried, or convicted of any offense in connection with the Boston Stranglings.
So this is sort of one of those moments, to go back to one of the themes you sort of brought up early, what does this tell us about us as a society? I mean, if some of these stories sort of hold lessons that we don't want to focus on about who we are, what's the one here?
Well, I think that the Boston Strangler became famous in part as a quasi-logical extension of a very logical impulse, which is the desire to protect ourselves. When you have the feeling that someone is running around killing your neighbors, you naturally worry about who it is. Albert DeSalvo came forward after the stranglings had stopped. It had been several months between the last of the stranglings clearly identified with the series and the time that Albert DeSalvo began to confess. So that was a way of, this is a terrible pun, sorry, tying a bow around the story and putting an end to it.
Mm. So one of the elements at play here in the Boston Strangler case is the highly publicized nature of this case. And you write about the effect that this has on the criminal justice system. We saw it play out in a big way in the O.J. Simpson murder case, and you write about this. What happens to the criminal justice system when these sensational stories get picked up by the press and magnified in this way?
Well, I should say off the top that I'm very much convinced that the phenomenon of making certain crimes famous does much more good than it does harm. However, it does enormous harm at the same time. When stories like O.J. Simpson and JonBenet get blown up so much beyond their natural proportions, it causes people involved to act differently than they normally would. And it quite often, causes the system of justice not to work. It can be a serious problem.
Mm. On the other hand, it provides an important pathway for public involvement into the criminal justice system, doesn't it? And isn't that important?
It is, because if we stay out of this system of criminal justice and leave it to the lawyers, that will result in a system that works very, very well for the lawyers. If we want the system to work for the rest of us, then we need for the rest of us to get involved in making it work. It's my argument that these popular crime stories, these celebrated murders that fill up our television sets, are or could be a way for people to get involved in the real and serious issues about the pursuit of justice.
Mm. You also offer some theories about that, about the criminal justice system in general, and you talk about this tension between liberals and conservatives and the way that argument has shaped the criminal justice system over the years, and you believe that both sides get it wrong.
My argument is that the liberals are hung up on a very limited set of ideas, which are ensuring that the rights of the accused are in no way violated or infringed upon. The conservatives are hung up on a very limited set of ideas, harsher punishment, longer sentences. These are two lousy sets of ideas, and they don't work together worse than they don't work separately. It is my argument, more optimistically, that if we could get past that, we could make astonishing progress against crime in a very short period of time. We need a criminal justice system that incarcerates the right people for the right crimes and helps them to avoid offending again.
Well, I think that's an encouraging note upon which to end this. Bill James, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Bill James. He's a special advisor to the Boston Red Sox. His new book is Popular Crime: Reflections on the Celebration of Violence. You can read an excerpt from his book on our website, radioboston.org.
We'll be back after a short break, and when we do, a call to protect Peace Corps volunteers from sexual assault. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.